Anyways, yeah, it's Dan.
And that was some pretty terrible harmonica playing, I must say. I'm really focusing on the keyboard right now. My ability with a harmonica is at best a kind of insult. Yeah, it's terrible. And my throat's a little scratchy, so I apologize for that. If it seems scratchy, yeah, that's my bad. My bad, my issue. Scratchy, scratchy voice. So anyways, this is Little Saigon Report number 4, and you know who I am. It's November the 24th, 2018. I don't know what to tell you. I wish I could say my outlook has improved. It hasn't gotten worse. You know, that's always a blessing when you can say that your perspective on the world has not gotten worse. It just means everything is up from there. And that's a good thing, you know, the whole blue sky and whatnot. I am working on a couple projects. I kind of spent, to be blunt, about a month wallowing over the situation that happened in my last software contracting gig. And I don't have to say, it's one of those things where at this point for me, I just have to accept a certain amount of torture. I will never at this point fit into the Seattle culture. And I really don't fit into the culture of most cities now, because cities everywhere. I mean, even Indianapolis, I got to tell you, you'd say, well, what about Indianapolis? Even Indianapolis had a certain zeitgeist that was more or less like Seattle. I mean, it's all becoming the same. Let me put it this way. If you want a job, you're going to end up working in that part of the city that has a certain perspective. And yeah, some of these cities might be more Republican than Democrat, but they're more or less all, you know, pretty strong statists who are pro-war, you know, really okay with blowing people up, totally okay with, like, calling Julian Assange some type of criminal because he did the most terrible thing. He told the truth, and he told the truth to power, and Republicans and Democrats both hate that shit, so Julian Assange is fucking screwed. I mean, he must have known that from day one, that it was a gambit, that there were no people in positions of authority, none, that would be on his side. None. Not like there'd be one or two. And sure, he could go to Ecuador's frickin' embassy for a few years, but that kind of just shows you how fucked up his situation was from the get-go. No one was on his side. He was more hated than, you know, frickin' Hannibal at the end of the Second Punic War. And believe me, that's a reference you don't want to use on a Saturday. So yeah, I don't fit into the zeitgeist of Seattle. I don't fit into the zeitgeist of most of these cities now. You know, zeitgeist meaning spirit of the time. It's everywhere. I'm not part of that core culture. I'm really not conservative, and I'm not liberal. But for the most part, I believe some fairly simple things. I kind of wish people could rationally and voluntarily solve problems without the use of force. That's more or less it. Like, rationally, intelligently, compassionately solve problems without the use of force. Voluntarily. Now, of course, I'm describing anarchism, but really, at this point, that's just another word, too. I've run into communists who call themselves anarchists. I've run into future cult leaders who call themselves anarchists. Lots of people will call themselves anarchists for lack of any vocabulary or understanding of what these words mean. But what I will tell you explicitly, and you can call this whatever the fucking you want to, you can call agorism or anarchism or whatever, you can call it Danarchism, since my first name is Dan. I don't really care, although that's probably already used, trademarked, so I just, you know, create more problems for myself. But yeah, it would be great to wake up one day and to live in a world where people could engage with each other without the use of force, without the threat of force, without saying, oh, I'm going to vote in the next election and I'll make sure that some cop knocks on your door to shove a pipe up your butt. You know, listen, we don't need to do that. But that's what it is. And what's the worst part is people say, well, we used to be a republic. Let me tell you something about the Roman Republic. The Roman Republic led to Caesar. Okay, these things were connected. People who like to pretend, and I used to do this. I used to delude myself long ago when I still believed in the concept of limited government. I never believed in government a whole lot, but I thought I was one of those small government Republicans, you know? Libertarian Republican, if such a thing could exist, I pretended I was one of those things. And I gotta say, while I was in the service, and I was in the service for a few years, those beliefs were put under tremendous stress because a lot of the things I was told, you know, that I was told were true, turned out to be absolutely false. Do not lie, cheat, or steal. When I was an officer, you know, training to be an officer in the United States military, I was told officers don't lie, cheat, or steal. In my first fucking year on active duty, I saw officers lying, cheating, and stealing. And I'd like to say that that, you know, varied with my second assignment, but it didn't. And I was never in combat. Like, the closest I got to anybody being pissed off at an American with a weapon, I was in Korea for a year. But for the most part, as unstable as Korea is, there is a kind of meta stability. So yes, crazy shit happens there, but I was never in combat. So yeah, I guess I'm kind of going off topic here a bit. Maybe not. This is a report, right? Although, is it about Little Saigon or is it about me? Does it really fucking matter? Do you care? Yeah, I would love to live in a world where people could basically treat each other with respect. No one's perfect, but the lack of perfection is really an issue of what I would call tolerance for reality. No one is perfect. I'm not perfect, but there are things I will never do, and there are things none of us should ever do. For example, sometimes we'll get angry with each other and say mean things. And as terrible as that is not the equivalent to hitting somebody over the head with a rock. Now, the fact that I have to explain this to people, that there's a difference between saying something that's mean and you are not being held captive so you can walk the fuck away. There's a difference between that and basically going up to somebody from behind late at night and beating them over the head with a rock. And yet, at this state of American civilization, most of the people, young and old, this isn't a millennial thing. This is an almost fucking every American thing. It's one of the reasons why I hide out all the time. A lot of Americans believe that bad words and bad actions are the same thing. They believe that thoughts in their heads are the same thing as actual reality. This is a scary time. A lot of crazy people who believe that the use of a word is equivalent to the use of a gun. And if that's something that you believe, you need to examine reality. But that isn't something I believe. So yeah, none of us is perfect. Some of us will say mean things, but that's not the equivalent to physical violence. And as long as you have a means of egress, as long as you have a way of getting away from the scary speech, the scary words, then I don't see the long-term harm. But that's just my belief. And, you know, as far as, like, terrible people doing terrible things, yeah, that's probably always going to happen. And with government, it seems to be capable of happening on a scale unprecedented in human history. So if the fear is there are bad people out there, then you definitely never want to establish a fucking government. Because that's essentially setting up a giant mountain of dynamite that the most recent crazy motherfucker can say, holy shit, look at that mountain of dynamite. All I need to do is attach a trigger to it. That's what government is. And so if you think people are terrible, you should be an anarchist anyways, really. But really a lot of these people say, well, people are terrible, therefore we need a government. And it's like, holy shit, that is, to me, that's like saying people are terrible, therefore we need to build a giant super weapon that like a sword of Damocles hangs over everybody's head every day of the week. That's how you solve the bad people problem. And what I can tell you is that might be how you solve the human problem, which means eventually you will build not just a figurative dynamite, but like we did with the atomic bomb in World War II, eventually you will build the giant mountain of dynamite, you know, like Putin's dead man switch and stuff like that. And eventually somebody who is horrifically evil will get, you know, access to, if not all of it, some of that terrible mountain of dynamite. So yeah. Anyways, it would be wonderful to wake up on some day and just say to yourself, we don't need police because we police ourselves. we don't need an army because we don't need to take other people's shit, and we want to live in a world where people won't take ours. Now, does that mean I don't believe in self-defense? Hell no. I actually think the corollary of the principles I'm discussing, which are really in essence the non-aggression principle, not original to me, the corollary of that is probably everyone should think of, on a personal level, and almost as a moral obligation, self-defense. And I would say self-defense plus one degree of proxy, which means that you have a right to defend yourself or that person you're connected to immediately, like your children, your wife, your friend, someone in your environment who is asking for your help. You have a right to defend them as well. But what you don't have a right to do is form thug armies and go around your neighborhood knocking on doors and saying, holy shit, you might be a bad person, so we're going to make sure we take all your weapons. Or we're just going to beat you up a little just so that you know that we're in charge. See, that's the thing. And it's not subtle to me, but it seems extraordinarily subtle to most Americans now, the difference between those things, the difference between one situation and the other. You have a right to defend yourself, okay? This is a real thing. You don't have a right to be a bully, okay? Now, no one is going to create a world without bullies, but the best antidote to a bully, you know, in many ways, is a firearm, or at least some type of combat training, you know, maybe martial arts, maybe a handheld, you know, crossbow or something. But the point is, the best antidote to a bully in the end is the ability to defend yourself. And sometimes you don't have to seriously harm the other person, but you do have to be able to defend yourself. Bullies thrive on the sheep. Bullies do not thrive on wolves. Anyways, not that I think we should be wolves, and some of these comparisons and analogies are just ridiculous. But yeah, so one of the topics I keep coming back to, and I thought I would dwell on it a bit because of all the shit in the news recently. Really terrible shit. And as preface to this, I don't know. I think my brain is completely fried, so it's irrelevant. But a long time ago, I studied military history. Never got my PhD, but got a master's degree. Pretty pathetic, pretty mediocre. But I fashioned myself as someone who understood, at least on some level, military history, strategy, tactics, and operations. And I would say I still do. You know, between that and being in the Army, I think that stuff got drilled into me. But it's been many years since I felt comfortable talking about this in any long, you know, in any big sense. Like, I have mixed feelings at this point. First few years out of the Army, I kind of just had a lot of questions. So, yeah, I've got mixed feelings, and I don't really like talking about that. But you know, I don't think I'm a moron when it comes to the subject. And so I'll see these articles that pop up. And there have been a lot of articles in the last year about Chinese hypersonic weapons. And I would even say Chinese super weapons. Like the Chinese, you know, have really advanced laser technology, and the Chinese are building hypersonics, and the Chinese have a rail gun on a barge ready to be used. The Chinese are building fake islands and, you know, all these things about China. And I will say this, there's reason to be alarmed by some of this. I'm not going to say that I'm not going to feed into the militarism because I'm just totally against that. But I will say this, and this is just one of those terrible things to mention. There is that scenario, and it is related to this whole Thucydides trap concept, which I think is a bit problematic because it almost sounds like the excuse for an alcoholic to drink. But essentially, the Thucydides trap goes like this. If you have a situation of relative stability where one particular power controls most of that area strategically, and then over time another power starts to emerge, you eventually reach a point where you have to figure out a way to deal with that emergent power. And in the Thucydides trap, he's talking about the Peloponnesian War and Athens and Sparta and that whole fucking rigmarole. And I don't want to talk about that. But the notion of Thucydides trap is relatively simple. It does have to do with a unipolar kind of strategic reality transitioning to a multipolar strategic reality. And can that be done without war? And it also deals with the issue of really a descendant power, which means that it's not just other powers are emerging, but usually, and this was true for Athens, just as it was true for Turkey and the Austro-Hungarian Empire before World War I, and Russia as well, is that you have an ascendant power that might be losing its vigor economically, socially, culturally, whatever. I just don't want to go into that too much. So there have been all these articles about, you know, these hypersonic weapons, and China is emerging, and they are in many ways, or at least they have been emerging, because of our most favored nation trade status. And I don't know about Trump and the whole trade war thing. I don't want to get into that topic. I will say, you will know the trade war is really happening when you go to Best Buy exists, but when you go on Amazon and you try to buy a new TV set and you figure out, holy shit, this just went up 3 times. Like, this is 300% what it was a year ago. I think when the trade war between China and the U.S. kicks off, there's going to be a few years, maybe 10 years. It will work its way through, but at least maybe 5 years, where there's going to be extraordinary price increases in certain areas because basically that part of our economic infrastructure was outsourced for 20 years. And there's been some significant changes in the field of electronics in the last 20 years, you know, no offense to reality. So yeah, you'll know the trade war's happening when the TV set that you bought for $400, you know, last year is costing $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 or more, and who knows. It's one of those things where it's horrible to think about. So yeah, the situation with China is not great, and it is kind of a Thucydides trap. But what's worse than the Thucydides trap vis-a-vis China and the United States, because China's emerging, the United States has got issues. We have issues, let's be honest. What's worse about this is this kind of what I would call the false narrative of success. And this is a well-known subject. You know, some people call it, I don't know, I think they call it the free throw the free throw fallacy or something, where if you keep getting the basketball in the hoop, and you did it 2 times in a row, and you did it 3 times in a row, so you must be able to do it 4 times in a row. Like, basically, the assumption is that you can't fail, and that you'll always succeed, or at least you'll succeed in some sense that, you know, keeps everything whole, so to speak. How this relates to the whole issue of war, which is horrible, and military and stuff like that is kind of simple. There's been a period of time, and I would say most of the 20th century and most of the 21st century so far. So there's been almost 100 years where both in the Western Hemisphere and also around the world, the United States has kind of been the big man on the block. I mean, even before World War I, people understood that the United States was becoming a power to be reckoned with, that just simply couldn't be controlled in any real sense. And the United States has become quite powerful. And it's not that we've won every battle or won every war. Here's the thing. The Romans, as the Roman Empire grew, they didn't win every war the first time. You know, there were two Punic Wars, okay? And actually, Carthage wasn't destroyed until technically the Third Punic War, or the destruction of Carthage. So there's really three Punic Wars of a sort, the third being, you know, horrible for the Carthaginians, but for the most part being not so exciting for the Romans. But the bottom line is, the Romans didn't win every battle. They didn't win every war the first time, but they never gave up. And they kept fighting, and for the most part, they had certain features of their way of engaging with the world that gave them an edge. And that's a good word, edge, because you can apply that to a knife. Okay, knives have edges. A dull knife is less threatening than a sharp knife. Now, it's not that dull knives can't kill, they can, but a sharp knife, obviously, is more dangerous, right? You can think of competing powers in either a two-person game theory model, or an N-person. And really, we're in kind of what I would call a hierarchical N-person problem. There's more than one competitor. They're not all weighted equally. So you can kind of think of this as a complex kind of scenario, not just N-bad, which means N as in the variable N, not just bad in terms of N, but ultimately bad because there's additional variables that shape N. And these variables have to do with something like what we would call competitive edge. You know, you can think of a military like a knife. Some knives are sharp, some knives are dull. And the reason why one knife might be sharp and the other's dull isn't just because of training or morale. No offense to training or morale. Training and morale is great, but often it has to do with the very science of war itself. It has to do with technology. It has to do with theory and operations. These things converge. You know, it's kind of like Gustavus Adolphus during the 30 Years' War. He engineered significant changes, not just in terms of tactics and strategy, but in terms of weapons. So it's one of those things where you kind of have to say to yourself, okay, on a very simplistic level, you can take all these variables, you can group them together and treat them like a knife. Some knives are sharp, some knives are dull. Okay, currently the United States knife, I don't know if it's sharp or dull. You know, if there really is $21 trillion missing from the United States government budget over the last 20 years, if that's actually true, then God knows, maybe they do have some sort of super advanced hyperspace fleet somewhere orbiting Mars, so that if anybody takes us on, they can just swoop in with their, you know, their starships and just vaporize their cities. Who the fuck knows? I don't know. I mean, the whole secret space program thing is really Doritos for the brain. I'm not really sure what's going on there. But assuming what I've been told is true by people I would trust, people still in the military, then the military of the United States is going through some issues. And it can be thought of as a dull knife, at least relative to itself a few decades ago. Whereas, you know, you look at China and its hypersonic weapons and blah, 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 and you say, holy shit, this is amazing. Their knife is getting sharper. Now, here's the thing. The current perspective of our leadership is that we have been so successful. This is also like the Romans. And up until the Battle of Adrianople, you know, in 378, I think it was, up until then, for the most part, like I said, the Romans didn't win every war, but they always won eventually. The Romans didn't win every battle, but eventually they won the war. That's the Romans had a kind of advantage in the way that they did things. But then you get to the Battle of Adrianople, and this is the state of Roman civilization where things are just really just falling apart. And yet they're still operating on the same assumption. We are the best. This is a problem. You know, the United States, for a period of time, for a period of history, had the sharpest knife in the drawer. Lots of knives were in the drawer. There was a German knife and the Japanese knife, and there was, you know, the Soviet Union knife. But for many, many decades, the United States had the sharpest knife in the drawer. That doesn't mean we won every battle. That doesn't mean we won every war. But eventually, we would win the war and eventually won the battles. You know, and when I say the sharpest knife, this isn't always about military engagement. Sometimes it's about bribery. Sometimes it's about clandestine operations. Sometimes it's about assassinating leaders. The point is, we had a scope of control for so many decades, which included our military, but all of our assets, intelligence and otherwise. We had a scope of control where if we didn't like a leader in, let's say, Argentina, you know, and his name happened to be Allende, we could say, you know, we don't like Allende, goodbye. You know, adios Allende. This is how we could do things for decades. That does not mean we were perfect, but we had the sharpest knife in the drawer. And again, I'm not using sharp knife as a positive here, okay? This is that, going back to that analogy about government being a mountain of dynamite, I am not saying having a sharp or dull knife is a good thing in this context. You know, if you have a gun or a knife for self-defense as an individual sovereign human being, I think that's great. If you form a bunch of people together and start threatening your neighbors, I think that's terrible. And if you can't tell the difference, I think you have a problem, which is most people these days. But yeah, for many decades, we were the sharpest knife in the drawer, and we still think we are. And I think in many ways, that's the core problem, or at least maybe a significant feature of the Thucydides trap, is that the nation that actually has issues, that actually should back away from war, thinks that it can win all the time. A really good example of this is the Russo-Japanese War. The Russians went into the war with Japan with incredible stereotypes and racism about the Japanese people, and incredible, like, perumphory and ebullience about their own abilities. Like, we are the Russian Empire, and we'll bring our Russian Navy somehow. I mean, if we can keep them filled with coal. Somehow we'll get our Russian Navy to the Pacific, and we'll kick the Japanese butts. Well, the long and the short of it is, if you don't know, the Japanese won that war. And they did it in part because they had better technology, and in part because they had better tactics. They actually had these things during the Russo-Japanese War called torpedo boats. And torpedo boats were pretty cool because you could go around at relatively high speed and launch torpedoes. So the Russian ships entered theater at comparably slow speed, and these little torpedo boats could basically swarm attack and whatnot. So bottom line is, and I don't want to oversimplify the naval history because I'm sure there's some naval historian or Annapolis grad who wants to shiv me at this point, fuck you. This is the best I can come up with on a Saturday morning after 60 days of personal, deep existential ennui of being, you know, involuntarily touched by a manager at my last contract. So, yeah, we thought we were the sharpest knife in the drawer. We still think we're the sharpest knife in the drawer. Trump, I don't like Hillary, I don't like Trump, but, you know, for all the things that people say about them being, you know, alternative and not being in the system, the people that support Trump are coming up with excuses for his militarism, but he is just as militaristic as every other bastard that sat in the Oval Office. He wants to renew the U.S. nuclear arsenal. These hypersonic weapons are scary. He wants, you know, our own hypersonics. I don't want to go into hypersonics. They actually are kind of scary in terms of what they're capable of doing. But again, pretty much any weapon is scary, and talking about this is a fetish. The bottom line is, he's a militarist too. He thinks that we cannot lose. If we just, you know, if you just elect me, we will never lose again. We'll always win. This is a bad thing. This is a formula. All you need for this formula to explode is another dance partner. And the dance partner is China. And here's China's problem. China's has been addicted to the U.S. consumer by opening up markets, by creating most favored nation status. And this happened under, you know, I think Herbert Walker Bush, but it kind of started under Nixon by China opening up, and through the late 70s and 80s, and then big time in the 90s, by China opening up, China was able to expand economically and grow at incredible rates. But China also became extremely dependent upon the U.S. consumer. And so this idea that a trade war with China can simply sell shit to the Russians or the Indians, listen, Indians have money because they're, you know, for the same reason why I go into a software shop in Seattle and I don't find a lot of white people. No offense to Indians and Chinese people. Listen, there's a lot of money in India also because our markets have been open, because of our IT and services markets being open, and because of outsourcing. So between the services outsourcing and the industrial outsourcing, India and China, but the focus now is China, China's become incredibly dependent upon us, both in terms of services outsourcing and, you know, raw technology production, TV sets, and you name it, all kinds of computer, you know, consumer electronics, and you name it. Bottom line, China really needs the U.S. consumer. So on one side, you have the dude that thinks his knife is super sharp, and that's the United States. That's us. That's the United States. And on the other side, you have China that actually has a knife and a knife sharpener, and is actually getting that knife sharper every day, but is also getting hungrier. And this is similar to the situation of Japan just before World War II. You know, we created a situation economically with Japan that kind of forced their hand. I don't want to oversimplify. And listen, there's a deeper reality to history that I don't want to go into right now. But the bottom line is, on the surface, if we just talk about the surface layer, on the surface, you know, there were Roosevelt's 10 points. There was the shutting down of oil and steel. And ultimately, China had about 18 months of oil left before their economy was going to grind to a halt. So that was their situation in December 1941. They were about a year away from going back to the essentially where they were 100 years before, which was, you know, the 17th century. They were about they were just basically a year and a half away. So this thing, the situation between China and the U.S. is really about a bully with a dull knife and a relatively strong, smaller dude. I don't mean in terms of numbers of people, but in terms of raw, you know, capability. This other dude, but with a knife that's getting sharper every day and with a stomach that's getting tighter every day. That's a formula for war, just so you know. And here's another little factoid for all you free traders and globalists. I will tell you this explicitly. But when it comes to free trade, free trade's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, and when I say free trade, I don't think that this kind of trade's free trade. I believe in just no controls. So call that free trade if you want to. But I would prefer two individuals or two businesses engaging with each other across, you know, international boundaries without the government being involved at all. Period. Zero. No involvement at all. That's my idea of what a free trade would look like. What we do for free trade is bullshit. It's very crony, very selective, and it does not allow for any type of creative engagement between parties across international borders. So anyways, if this trade war goes too far, if it goes too long, China will find itself in a situation where they either give in to our demands, and I think the demands will get worse because our situation economically is not that great. So this idea that we, you know, that Trump will do some deal with China that will leave them enough, I think the reality is whatever deal gets made, if it gets made, China will end up in a bad situation. They will have a growth issue. And I don't want to talk about growth issues and societal stability. That's not the topic of the podcast today. But growth issues for societies that have been rapidly growing are really, really bad. You know, C. Davies, 1962, Toward a Theory of Revolution. See that particular PDF if you can find it. But societies that undergo tremendous growth in living standards and then suffer huge setbacks, even if in real terms they're still better off than they were 100 years ago, it doesn't matter. That's not how people think, and that's essentially the problem. So the Chinese situation is quite unstable in that sense. If they don't keep growing, they start dying, and the ability for the Central Committee to maintain control, that gets really, that gets weaker and weaker. And a China undergoing civil war, or a China that becomes a warlord-type republic, where you have many leaders in many countries, a China of three countries, which is three countries in 10 years, is not impossible. And these are things, these are topics that I'm sure, even if they don't believe they'll happen because they're incapable of losing in their own way. But these are topics that are probably discussed amongst the hierarchy of the Chinese Communist Party. So ultimately, you have a bad situation. And I don't want to belabor it, but here's the thing. Technology can be such a fun thing when you think of it in terms of video game reality. You can say, oh, it's really cool, hypersonic weapons. And oh, those rail guns are so cool. And, oh, the Russians are going to have a hypersonic jet, you know, like Firefox. And it's really fun and exciting. But you have to realize these are basically weapons designed to kill lots and lots of people. That's what they're designed for. They're designed for mass murder and mass terror and mass destabilization. And even if you think you have the best weapons, even if you think your knife is the sharpest one in the drawer, history tells us one thing. Everyone's knife will eventually get dull, unless you're going to just have a perpetual war society. Now, that's kind of Napoleon said the same thing once. The only thing you can't do with bayonets, so this is what Napoleon said, the only thing you can't do with bayonets is sit on them. And what he meant by that was, if you're going to have a society of force and war, you always have to use the force. You always have to be at war. Your knife has to always be sharpened. So is it possible for a power to be in control all the time, forever? Maybe, although it sounds a lot like a perpetual motion machine in sociological terms. But even if that's true, such a society, that society would be horrific. I mean, it would be worse than Sparta. Sparta would look mild by comparison. And the scary thing about America today is that it looks like they're trying to engineer something like that. They want us to be a society capable of being at war 24/7 forever. Anyways, it's Christmas season, right? So I should probably let you guys go off this little Saigon report, and let's hope and pray that cooler heads prevail. Bye-bye.